From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for December 20th, 2015, the last Sunday before Christmas. Thanks for joining me as we take our weekly look at the politics of recent days and also what lies ahead. Yes, it's time to grab the Sunday paper and that warm cup of coffee, and we'll try to get things warmed up this morning. Well, Dave, it was great to see you and everyone else on Friday when WGN had its live radio play performance.
Wasn't that fun?
Miracle on Jerry Wells Street, our homage to Jerry Wells, the station's recently retired executive assistant. You know what was amazing was all of the production work that it takes to do this.
Oh, yeah.
But I thought it was just classic. We were up on the seventh floor in Campbell Hall. We're actually, you know, in the vintage days, a lot of radio shows were done up there. But I thought it was so neat to have those 1930s-era microphones.
Yeah, those were, and someone, one of the engineers, Bill Malone, who was working, told me that they're RCA microphones. They're classic-looking microphones, but I can't remember the model number. Being a microphone geek, as it were, I can't remember the model number, but they were vintage RCA microphones that WGN used actually many, many years ago. So it was great to bring those back.
And I understand those microphones are probably better than what we've got right now.
Well, they're as good for voice work, yeah. They just are. And
I mean, I had to stand like 3 feet away from the microphone.
Yeah, you don't have to work those closely like you do, you know, present-day microphones. We're up. You know, we get up right up to them fairly close these days, but you don't have to do that with those older microphones.
And so I was afraid because it didn't have a spit guard on it. I didn't.
Well, yeah, you know, it doesn't matter when you're standing 2 feet away from it. There, 6 inches, yes, but 2 feet.
But it was it's tremendous. You can find the show online, but just a whole lot of fun. And I have to tell you, I was talking about the production work involved. So I went back and actually listened to the podcast of it because I noticed that when we were in the room, we couldn't really hear any or all of the sound effects that were interspersed.
Right.
In there.
They were using sound effects for, you know, the sound of general noise or the din of noise in the department store.
Well, even
door
closings.
Door closings, yeah, right.
Steps, you know, all those kinds of things that we learned way back in when we were in college and on how to do a reel-to-reel broadcast.
You're taking me back here. You're taking me back.
Well, we're both going back. That's the issue. Because I think the first class I had in broadcasting was, do I really want to go there? 1977? And we had to produce like a old-time radio show on reel-to-reel tape.
Yeah, we did the same thing.
And spliced the tape.
Yeah, we did the same thing. We did.
Which is why I'm a lousy gift wrapper.
I was pretty good at splicing tape, but gift wrapping, yeah, I'm not too good at that.
Well,
two different skill sets there.
Yeah, well, and I did apologize to Dave that I didn't gift wrap his present, and for Bob Ferguson here, I have his present unwrapped, which is a Billy Goat T-shirt and
look at this.
A stocking cap.
I don't think I've seen one of these before.
Well, see.
Bob Ferguson making a rare appearance on the air, ladies and gentlemen. Oh,
and it's in Billy Goat blue.
Of course, yes. And, you know, what? Actually, he was a big part of the show, too, on Friday.
Yeah, running the control board back in the studio. Yeah,
yeah.
I don't remember the model number on those either, but 1933, I believe they
Did
were
they go,
made.
Go back that far?
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
Because wow. The station went on the air in 26?
24. Yeah.
I wonder whose basement those were in. I want to know whose basement they're in now.
See how far we've come? Now you have people doing their internet podcasts from their basement.
Right,
you
exactly.
Know, so
on those mics. On those,
yeah. yeah, just a whole lot of fun and a great – so great to have everybody together, too, because with everybody working different shifts and those kinds of things.
It really was what you'd want the Christmas holiday spirit to be.
Yeah, I'm sorry I couldn't stay for the team picture because I had to get back to my day job on the fourth floor at Tribune Tower with never a dull moment in politics. It never takes a holiday. But when I came in yesterday, too, I'd forgotten that it was a noon Blackhawks game yesterday, so I was able to get the show prep done, although you'll be able to tell maybe I was a little distracted because I had more Blackhawks in my headphones than politics going on. But I will tell you, I got to see the third period, and this is I tweeted out, this is why I love this team. I mean, they're down 2-1 just in the last couple of minutes. Buffalo gets a bad call. Two guys get pulled into the penalty box. The Hawks have a 5-on-3 to finish out the game. And Patrick Kane, the hometown kid, scores the tie score. They go play overtime. Blackhawks had a man advantage, didn't work. And they went to that hated shootout. And there was only one goal scored in the shootout, and it was by Patrick Kane. And, you know, I played hockey in high school, and those curved blades to shoot a backhand puck and elevate it, you know, 5 feet, the way he is able to do that is nothing short of magic. And truly, the Buffalo goalie never stood a chance. And I'd encourage anybody, if you haven't seen the replays on TV, go take a look at it on YouTube. It's got to be there. But it was just an amazing way to finish a game. And a great way to get the rest of the games over early, get to enjoy the rest of the day, get some of that shopping done, that kind of thing. And temperatures are supposed to be warming up today, right, Dave?
Somewhat, yes. Actually,
relative
in the
to.
40. Yeah, relative to. But, yes, around upper 40s today. Low of only 44 tonight and maybe 50 tomorrow, but rain is in the forecast. And, by the way, the first full day of winter is Tuesday.
And what's that supposed to be like?
Tuesday, right. We are looking at, if you will give me just a second
sorry,
to call
to
up our magical
guard.
Forecast here. Tuesday, we are looking at partly sunny, high near 48. So this talk of a mild winter, by comparison, seems to continue. And we're looking at precipitation-wise into the week, rain.
That's
And for Christmas Day, partly sunny, high near 46. Doesn't look like much chance of a white Christmas.
No, I would say not. And I was I have one of the downstate National Weather Service offices in Lincoln, Illinois, is on my Twitter feed.
Yeah,
just for when I have to travel to Springfield, and they're looking at temperatures 65 midweek
down in Lincoln,
Lincoln,
Bloomington area.
Yeah, I mean,
wow.
Something strange is going on.
We've had Christmas days where it's hit 60 here.
Yes.
And some friends of mine went out and played golf. They did.
Well,
after Christmas dinner, it's 60 degrees. I'm getting the clubs. I'm playing golf.
Well, when I lived in Springfield, I remember one year I played a round of golf at least once every month of the year. And my rule was...
You could
was,
get away with it there.
My rule was it had to be 50 degrees.
Well, and, yeah.
well, no. I mean, some guys they'll
get out
in
when
40s.
It's in their 40s. Yeah,
yeah. But you get that kind of sting in the club kind of feeling,
yes.
You know, like a cold baseball bat kind of sting sometimes. But no, 50 degrees, and yeah, it tends to be about 10 degrees warmer down there, which is one reason why back then I had a little Mustang convertible to drive around in. Not exactly the car you want to use in Chicago winters.
No. No.
There
you could do it.
There you could do it. So you're done with Christmas shopping?
I have two more items to get, and then I'll be done. Yes.
And
I know what I need to do. I know where to go. And so, yeah, it's.
If you don't know where to go, I'm sure there's plenty of
people
to tell you.
People have told me where to go all of my life.
Yes, indeed.
All different kinds of places.
Well, Merry Christmas, Dave.
Merry Christmas to everybody.
You,
to Bob, to Jasmine, everybody. Yes, indeed.
Well,
and our listeners. The
absolutely,
best
of course, the best in the world. And thank you so much for tuning in this morning. And Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news and traffic. Producer Jasmine is fielding your phone calls, and you can reach us at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at that very same number, 312-981-7200. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin and on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is putting the last ornament on the tree here at Mighty 720. And as I said, you can find that Miracle on 34th Street adaptation on WGNRadio.com along with all of our past shows. And you can also get our podcasts at iTunes by searching Rick Pearson. Well, coming up, we've got another great show today. After Dave brings us the 7:30 news, we'll talk to my Tribune political team colleague Kim Geiger about last week's meeting with the governor and some, but not all, of the legislative leaders. After Dave's 8 o'clock newscast, we'll be talking to another of my Tribune colleagues, Annie Sweeney. And Annie covers police and courts, and we have the intersection of both going on in Chicago these days. Annie will tell us what a Department of Justice investigation into police practices and procedures means for the city. And after the 8:30 news, my friend David Yepsen joins the show. David is the executive director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale. And before that, and he still is to me, the go-to guy when it comes to politics in Iowa. He was at the Des Moines Register as the national political columnist. And we'll talk about these recent debates and whether that has influenced Iowa voters. That's all coming up. It's time for a break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Bells on bobtail ring, making spirits bright. What fun it is to ride and sing a sleighing song tonight. Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Oh, jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, being helped out here this morning by the University of Illinois Ripcords and their holiday music. It's time for our weekly spin through national politics, and it's been quite a week debate-wise. We had the Republican debate in Las Vegas earlier this week, and then the Democratic debate last night at St. Anselm College in Manchester, New Hampshire. And it appears that we also have the end to what had become a simmering dispute between Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and the Democratic National Committee over a data hacking incident. But I want to start out first with the Republican debate. And it was basically, I think, very notable for Jeb Bush trying to take on Donald Trump.
So Donald, you know, is great at the one-liners, but he's a chaos candidate, and he'd be a chaos president. He would not be the commander-in-chief we need to keep our country safe.
Mr. Trump. Jeb doesn't really believe I'm unhinged. He said that very simply because he has failed in this campaign. It's been a total disaster. Nobody cares. And frankly, I'm the most solid person up here. I built a tremendous company, and all I want to do is make America great again.
So you had Trump versus Bush was one theme of the Republican debate, but a developing one has become Senators Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz sparring over several issues, including immigration. But first, Rubio tried to take on Cruz over Cruz's support of ending the government's metadata mining program of telephone records.
We are now at a time when we need more tools, not less tools. And that tool we lost, the metadata program, was a valuable tool that we no longer have at our disposal.
Senator Cruz?
Well, I would note that Marco knows what he's saying isn't true. You know, Mark Levin wrote a column last week that says that the attack ads his super PAC is running that are saying the same thing, that they are knowingly false, and they are in fact Alinsky-like attacks like Barack Obama. And the reason is simple. What he knows is that the old program covered 20% to 30% of phone numbers to search for terrorists. The new program covers nearly 100%. That gives us greater ability to stop acts of terrorism. And he knows that, that's the case.
Dana, may I interject?
Senator, let me
be very careful in answering this, because I don't think national television in front of 15 million people is the place to discuss classified information. So let me just be very clear. There is nothing that we are allowed to do under this bill that we could not do before. This bill did, however, take away a valuable tool that allowed the National Security Agency and other law and other intelligence agencies to quickly and rapidly access phone records and match them up with other phone records to see who terrorists have been calling. Because I promise you, the next time there is an attack on this country, the first thing people are going to want to know is, why didn't we know about it and why didn't we stop it? And the answer better not be because we didn't have access to records or information that would have allowed us to identify these killers before they attacked.
We're going to continue our weekly spin through national politics, but first, a break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, a little bit of Christmas music, and then we'll be talking to my Tribune colleague, Kim Geiger, who is part of our political team who covers state government over at the Thompson Center. It's the University of Illinois Ripcords, and the soloist was the show's unofficial music director, my daughter Amanda, who I'm sure is listening and now is turning red, but a very beautiful rendition. We're going to be playing some of the music from just a few years ago when she was one of the leaders of the preeminent women's a cappella group there at the University of Illinois. But right now, joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio is my good friend and colleague, Kim Geiger. And Kim is part of the political team at the Chicago Tribune covering state government out of the Thompson Center. Glad to get you out of the Thompson Center and over here.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Although I guess both buildings are technically for sale, so.
That's right. Yes, they are.
You got your Christmas shopping done?
I'm waiting till the last minute on that.
Why?
I have an enormous family, and I have a number of nieces and nephews, so I like to wait till I get home, figure out what they all want, and then go out and do it.
Or I figure you just learn procrastination because you're covering state government.
Well, I'm a journalist, so well, I know how to procrastinate.
Well, there's also deadlines, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So. Yeah, but this one's like a week away still.
Oh, plenty of time. Plenty of time. Great, great, great. Okay, I won't count on anything from you. We had another of those, quote, big meetings this past week of the governor and legislative leaders with no real progress, despite the fact that everybody comes out of these meetings and says there was progress made, but there's nothing to show for it. But this meeting was different. This meeting lacked one of the main players on the stage.
Yes.
House Speaker Michael Madigan.
Yep, he did not show up.
And there was no explanation given. I know a daughter had a child, and that might have been the issue or whatever, but mm-hmm. there was no explanation or contact. Apparently, I think that's what the governor said.
The governor said that he was told a day or two before that the speaker wasn't going to make it, but that there was no explanation given. And then when I asked the speaker's spokesman, he just said that there was a scheduling conflict and that it had come up.
This lack of urgency that we see, and you know, so many times on the show we've talked about what could be pressure points to have to force some action. And you know, it's at one point I said my big fear is that it would take almost something like the I-35 bridge collapse in Minneapolis, a tragedy,
right,
to really make people move. But it just seems very lackadaisical.
Yeah, well, so you had a situation where the budget year began July 1st, and pretty quickly a lot of big items were taken care of. The governor went to court and got state workers to be paid. He signed a funding bill for K-12 education, so schools were still opening. And then there's a number of people who rely on money from the state who actually have existing court orders that say that the state is obligated to pay for their services. And those people went to court and said, hey, just because you guys are having a political fight in Springfield doesn't mean you're not still obligated to pay for the stuff
under
that
those
need.
Court orders.
Under those court orders, yeah. So a lot of those court orders freed up a lot more money, and so now you have a situation where there's really only a few kind of corners of state government that are not funded. The biggest one is colleges and universities, and you had a situation in the fall where, you know, that was around the time when this impasse was kind of ramping up and people weren't really sure how long it was going to last. But you've got one of the things that's not funded is like tuition grants for low-income students.
Monetary assistance.
Yeah,
monetary
the
MAP award,
grant program.
MAP grant monetary assistance program.
Yeah. And but so back in the fall, it was unclear when this whole thing was going to be resolved. And you had colleges and universities saying, hey, you know, we don't know when this is going to happen, but for now we'll sort of front those grants and not charge students the tuition that they would be paying with that grant money. And then we'll just use the money when we get it. Now you have a situation where since we're going now into the spring semester, you've got some colleges saying like, hey, we just don't have the money to front for a second semester of this. And then you have others saying, you know, we will put this forward for you, but there's the possibility that you might have to actually pay it back if the state never has a budget, which we're 6 months through, we're halfway through the budget year.
And this is really, now we talk a lot about the public university part of the mm-hmm. MAP grants, but this also affects private schools as well.
Yes, it affects private schools as well. And then on top of that, you have the public universities and colleges that are not getting the assistance that they would be getting.
They're not getting any state money at all.
Yeah, so they're it's a little worse for them because they rely on some dollars from the state and they're not getting any of that. And then on top of that, there's this scholarship issue.
And to me, when we're starting to hear this from the university presidents are starting to get more outspoken, sending letters to the governor and the four leaders. But it seems to me, especially at some of these smaller state universities, Western Illinois University, mm-hmm. Eastern Illinois mm-hmm. University, they don't have the endowments that, say, a U of I does,
right,
or even SIU might have. And that, you know, there are some real serious questions about the fate of those schools.
Yes. Yes. However, the governor was asked on Friday about the funding for higher education. He went to a public-private partnership high school program up at DeVry in Chicago on Friday and was talking about how, you know, he's big on education. He thinks that education should be better funded in the state. And he was asked about, you know, this budget impasse is creating this problem for higher education, and, you know, is there any consideration of maybe like creating some funding stream for that? And he said, you know, we can't get ourselves into a deficit one bill at a time. So it doesn't look like there's any willingness.
No, we're just doing it by one court order at
exactly.
a time.
Exactly. Exactly. And the thing is, this is one area where they don't have the argument that a lot of others have had about, you know, you're obligated to spend this money.
Well, and if you remember back in the campaign, too, that the governor was not speaking always highly about the public higher
no.
education system.
No.
And how he believed it needed some serious changes, that there was too much bureaucracy
yes.
in it, there was not enough money going into classrooms. You know, then you bring up, you know, tenure issues mm-hmm. and union issues on top of it. And his decision to kind of pick elementary and secondary education versus the universities under the guise that he supports education was kind of an interesting, you know, bifurcation of the issue here.
Yes, and it also allowed him to buy some time, right? Because if the state stops sending money to K-12 schools at the beginning of the school year, that could create like a huge catastrophe. Whereas by not funding the higher education institutions, those a lot of them do have endowments. They have a little bit more room to move and can kind of
or it
make
also,
it work.
Or
for
it
a
forces
while.
Them to restructure.
Yes,
in
there's that
ways
as well.
he'd like to see happen.
Yes,
we're speaking with Kim Geiger, a member of the political team covering state government at the Thompson Center. She is my colleague at the Chicago Tribune. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.
I don't want a lot for Christmas. There is just one thing I need. I don't care about the presents underneath the Christmas tree. I just want you for my own, more than you could ever know. Make my wish come true.
Thank you to the University of Illinois Ripcords for their great a cappella Christmas that we're having here on this final Sunday before Christmas. Rick Pearson here on the Sunday Spin here in the Allstate Showcase studio, joined by my Tribune colleague Kim Geiger. And Kim, when you talked to the governor late last week, did he indicate, like, is there another meeting going to be held anytime soon? Does he look like this is wearing it all on him at all as a first term governor?
Not really, but he says he's very frustrated. He says that he didn't expect this to take as long, and he feels like, I think the way he put it was that change happens in Illinois at a glacial pace. About the meetings.
Doesn't he know about climate change? No, but I mean, it's. I would imagine, though, without Madigan in the room,
yeah.
they might have covered a few more.
Oh, yeah.
Topics.
They were in there for an hour and 40 minutes. It was definitely the longest. This is the third meeting that they've had this month. They went like 5-6 months without meeting all five of them in the same room. And then some good government groups basically said, this is crazy. You guys need to sit down and talk. And
that's when they had the televised talking point session in Springfield.
Yes.
That was never going to accomplish anything except everybody got their commercial in.
Exactly. So they did that earlier in the month, and then they had another one, and then this was the third. And And like you said, the speaker did not show up for that. And so there was there was four instead of five. But they were in there for a really long time. Apparently, they talked about all of the items on the governor's turnaround agenda. But, you know, without Speaker Madigan there, what can you really do?
Right. It would be impossible to advance anything without his imprimatur. And that of course, has been leading to this question of, you know, everybody saying, how much longer can this go on? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've got people like former House Republican leader Tom Cross, when I was out at Aurora University recently, and he speculated that this could go till after the November election, after the general election.
Yeah.
When you have a lame duck legislature at that point.
It's true. And, you know, the interesting thing is now we're going into January, which would typically be when you would start thinking about a budget for the upcoming budget year.
For the presentation in February.
Yeah, exactly. The governor's going to need to give a budget speech in February, and it's very possible that speech is going to occur without there being a budget for the year that we are currently in.
And indeed, people are talking about his budget staff is working to put together a fiscal year 17 budget plan.
Right.
While we don't even know what the outcome of this is going to be.
Yes.
And, I mean, one thing is evident, though. The longer we go in this mess, the harder the decisions are going to be. Be it the amount of tax mm-hmm. that has to be raised mm-hmm. and the amount of cuts in spending mm-hmm. that will have to be done.
Right.
I mean, it becomes kind of a multiplier effect the longer we go.
Yes. Particularly because we're spending at a rate that was set when there was a higher income tax rate.
And that was that's the one that phased down in January of this year.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, we're looking at outpacing spending by anywhere from four to six billion dollars mm-hmm. with no answer for it.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then you throw in the Chicago issues.
Yes.
You've got $480 million in relief or cash for the public schools. You've got issues involving mass transit. You've got the city needing some pension relief for police and fire pensions.
Yeah.
And they're nowhere. I mean, it's kind of you kind of wonder about counting on Springfield to do something to help money-wise when Springfield can't do anything on its own for the state money-wise.
Well, and the governor has said that he thinks that the financial needs of Chicago will be the pressure point that kind of gets a deal going. But he also has called on the mayor to get Democrats in Springfield to pressure the Democrats in Springfield to go along with the governor's agenda that he wants. So this all ties back to that legislative agenda that the Democrats are opposed to. And there's no sign, at least right now, that the mayor is.
Well, Emanuel said he does not support the union weakening provisions of the governor's agenda.
Right.
And then, you know, in light of recent events, it's not exactly that you have Rahm Emanuel coming from a strong point of governance going on in this
city. Exactly. There's no sign that he's going to be able to go in and help Rauner get the votes, even if he wanted to. So that path, it's not clear to me how that path gets us to a budget. But the governor has said that he thinks that there's going to be this Chicago's financial system is going to create sort of
the impetus.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean, everybody is kind of waiting to see, particularly on the schools, because everybody points to after the first of the year and whether these financial pressures mm-hmm. Result in school closings mm-hmm. or in massive teacher layoffs. And you have the Chicago Public Schools trying to cut a deal with the CTU to avoid a strike and bargaining issues there. And, I mean, at some point, this is all going to come to a head. And But I can very well see, as you well know from going down to Springfield and seeing the legislature, there's a lot of legislators that it's, well, that's Chicago's problem.
Yes,
particularly the downstate legislators. Uh-huh. And then you have the issue of the Barbara Bird-Bennett contract, mm-hmm. which, you know, and the fraud that was committed there, which is only a further exacerbation of the ability of these downstate lawmakers to say, well, until they clean up their act.
Right.
And there's no shortage of Chicago bashers when it comes to the Illinois General Assembly.
No, there's not.
It's great times, I'll tell you, and never a dull moment. Kim Geiger, from our political team covering state government. Thank you for coming into the Allstate Showcase studio this morning.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, my new Tribune colleague, Annie Sweeney, making her debut appearance here on the Sunday Spin. She's a police and courts reporter for the Chicago Tribune, and she can kind of explain to us what the Department of Justice coming to Chicago and looking at the practices of the Chicago Police Department means for the city. Ba-bum, ba-bum.
Santa baby, just slip a sable under the tree for me. Then an awful good girl, Santa baby. So hurry down the chimney tonight. Oh, yeah. Santa baby, a 54 convertible to light blue. How I am for you, dear.
That's the University of Illinois Rip Chords from a couple years ago, and my daughter was attending the University of Illinois. It was kind of funny watching Dave, is kind of like me, we're kind of bebopping here. And
a 54 convertible will do. Clever line.
One of those classic, maybe one of those classic T-Birds with the
That's the first thing that came to mind. Yeah.
The hard top pull off to make it the convertible?
Yep. Yep. That's the first thing that came to mind.
Two-seat T-Bird then, right?
Yeah.
Those were two-seaters then.
Mm-hmm. And the early Corvettes were also.
Well, Corvettes were always
two-seaters. Always two-seaters, yes. Okay.
If you see a four-seater, though, we'll help buy that because that would be like.
I was thinking of something else, but you're right. Corvettes have always been two-seaters.
Well, that's Dave Schwann in the newsroom. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio. A little bit of Christmas music here, and I figure that'll help blunt some of the political rhetoric that's going on. We've been talking about this past week of debates, and you're really seeing this theme now of in the Republican presidential debate that Jeb Bush, whose campaign has been kind of languishing, is really on this calculated strategy that the only way he's going to try to make the numbers move is to go after Donald Trump. Here's one of their exchanges in last week's Republican presidential debate.
We need toughness. Honestly, I think Jeb is a very nice person. He's a very nice person, but we need tough people. We need toughness. We need intelligence, and we need tough. Jeb said when they come across the southern border, they come as an act of love.
You said in September 30th that ISIS was not a
am I
not
talking or are you talking, Jeb?
I'm talking right now. I'm talking.
You can go back. You're not talking. You interrupted me,
September 30th,
Jeb. Are you
going to
apologize, Jeb? No. Am I allowed to finish?
Yes, one at a time.
Excuse
go ahead,
me. Am I allowed to finish?
Go ahead, Mr. Trump.
So,
little of your
again,
own medicine
I,
there.
I know, Governor, you're trying Governor to build Bush, up your energy, please. Jeb, but it's not
one,
working
One at a time.
Well.
Yeah.
Look. We need a toughness. We need strength. We're not respected as a nation anymore. We don't have that level of respect that we need. And if we don't get it back fast, we're just going to go weaker, and just disintegrate. We can't allow that to happen. We need strength. We don't have it. When Jeb comes out and he talks about the border, and I saw it, and I was witness to it, and so was everyone else, and I was standing there, they come across as an act of love. He's saying the same thing right now with radical Islam. And we can't have that in our country. It just won't work. We need strength.
Governor Bush.
Donald, you're not going to be able to insult your way to the presidency. That's not going to happen. And I do have the strength.
A little exchange there between the Donald and Jeb exclamation point. Well, joining me now in this segment of the Sunday Spin is another Tribune colleague, Annie Sweeney, who covers the police and courts for the Chicago Tribune. Annie, thanks for getting up with me this morning.
Sure thing, Frank.
Well,
thanks for having me.
I mentioned at the outset of the show that police and courts reporter, and really you don't find that intersection so strong as you do right now with the Department of Justice now in town, taking a look at the Chicago Police Department.
That is true. There's several different levels going on here. There's a criminal investigation, two really. There's the civil rights investigation by the Department of Justice. So, yeah, there is a lot going on. It's been a very busy 3 weeks, for sure.
Now, In reading some of the stories about this that you've written with others at the paper, and this seems like one of the biggest jobs for DOJ to ever tackle as part of that practices and pattern investigation is the Chicago Police Department.
It is. It is, if not the largest, one of the largest departments they've looked at. You know, there's 10,000 officers in the department that they have to take a look at the whole system of how they're how the excessive force is used, and beyond that, how it's investigated.
I know you talked to the person who's head of the Civil Rights Division at DOJ, and you know, to me, a lot of people still ask questions about, you know, what are they going to look at, what aren't they going to look at? Can you maybe mm-hmm. walk us through that a little bit?
Sure. It's called a pattern and practice investigation because what they're looking for are systemic problems within the department. So they're not looking at individual officers, although there is one officer that was involved in this shooting that has led to the investigation. As you know, I think, Rick, you know, there have been years of concerns raised in civil suits, raised by I think the media has done numerous stories over the years documenting concerns about the Chicago Police Department. So what Loretta Lynch laid out, you know, when she announced the probe, is that they'd be looking at excessive force specifically, and as well as kind of the intake investigation, the handling of those incidents. So when citizens come forward and complain about an individual officer, how is that handled? How thorough is the investigation? Do they get to the bottom of it? And what's the follow-up? So it is limited, but, you know, this has been done in other departments, and there's no reason why the Chicago Police Department can't use this as an opportunity to kind of look at other issues.
Well, indeed, you talk to some, you know, experts involved in mm-hmm. criminal justice and policing and that kind of thing, and they're saying the city shouldn't necessarily wait till the outcome of what could be a 2-year investigation to start making changes. They should be proactive.
Right. They absolutely. More than one expert told us that there's no reason for Rahm Emanuel or anyone in the department to wait. So even before this investigation was announced, Rahm Emanuel had announced a task force. I think it was maybe a week before. But at any rate, and many people at the time said to us, there have been numerous task force here who have, you know, looked at this issue, and they weren't sure what to make of it. However, that task force might be in a position to do some of the proactive work that the experts are talking about. In fact, a member of the task force told me she expected they would be. You know, they'll be sending recommendations to the city council, to the mayor. What happens with them, I don't know.
But there are also concerns, too, that when you look at that task force, for example, you know, and you've heard this in some of the protests about how, well, we can't wait till March.
Right. Wait till March. When the
for recommendations to be.
Oh, yeah, sure. They don't. Yeah, I think, well, clearly people want some movement and action now, right? They're asking for resignations from the mayor, from Anita Alvarez. So I think it will be interesting to see how quickly they come up with anything specific. This week already there were meetings with the DOJ and Emanuel. I haven't been given any timetable, so I'm not sure when to expect anything. But
and of course, there was also talk too that from DOJ that they want to make sure that community involvement, the community's voice, is heard in this.
Yes, that's a huge piece of this. I've been told there'll be closed door meetings with community members. They may or may not follow up with individuals who have brought a complaint in the past to ask, you know, what was the process like? What were the interviews like? Did anyone follow up with you? How hard did they try to interview you? Did they call you once? Did they call you more than one time? And, you know, do you feel like you were treated fairly?
We're speaking with Annie Sweeney, my colleague at the Chicago Tribune, who covers police and courts, and we're talking about the Department of Justice Pattern and Practices investigation into the Chicago Police Department. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.
Deck the halls with boughs of holly, fa-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Tis the season to be jolly, fa-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Don we now our gay apparel, fa-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Troll the ancient yuletide carol, fa-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. See the blazing yule before us, fa-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Strike the harp and join the chorus, fa-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Follow me in merry measure, fa-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. While I tell of yuletide treasure, fa-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Fast away the old year passes, fa-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Hail the new ye lads and lasses, fa-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Sing we joyous all together, fa-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Heedless of the wind and weather, fa-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la.
Special thanks to the University of Illinois Ripcords for our Christmas music this morning. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio, and joining me on the phone is Annie Sweeney, who's a colleague at the Tribune covering police and courts. We're talking about the DOJ pattern and practices investigation into the Chicago Police Department. And Annie, one question people have asked is this issue about the code of silence, and something that Mayor Rahm Emanuel has acknowledged, even though at times the city has tried to fight any kind of affirmation of this, the police union saying that they aren't really going to discuss it at a city council joint committee hearing last week. Is that also part of the pattern and practices that might come under review by DOJ?
You know, it's not specifically mentioned by the government as an area. You know, they're not saying we want to come in and explore and unpack this code of silence, but certainly I think it's an issue that is related to the whole process of investigations and getting to the bottom of citizen complaints and or, you know, excessive force incidents. So will they specifically address it? I don't know, but perhaps the city, if it does take a proactive approach, might take a closer look at it. It is hard to tell. I have heard that the DOJ, I'm sorry, does try to stay focused on what their stated areas of investigation are.
But they say that they're not going to leave any stone unturned in this investigation.
Right.
So
right, exactly, and I think it's hard to imagine that this doesn't come up when you're looking at investigations and how they learn what happened in the aftermath of the Laquan McDonald shooting. The police reports that were released under a Freedom of Information request suggest that the responding officers didn't describe the incident as it happened. So it's already really an issue.
So what is the bottom line here after DOJ? And let's say they do find something here, and they do find a problem here. What is the process going forward? How is that remedied or adjudicated?
Mm-hmm. So after the very long investigation, a year or more, they will issue a findings letter or document, which will state whether, in fact, they found any systemic problems. Every expert I've spoken to believes they will, that they don't tend to start these unless it's heading in that direction. And then after that, they have indicated they intend to have a court-enforced plan to fix it, which is very often like a consent decree. So they go to a judge, a federal judge, and begin the process of implementing the reforms. An independent monitor is often brought in to help in that process, to help figure out what needs to be done.
And that monitor, will assess the progress that's being made.
Right, and then there will be numerous updates to the judge about how they're doing, what progress is being made. It is lengthy. L.A., I think it was 12 years, you know, before a judge lifted. Now, that doesn't mean there wasn't progress made within that time period.
But, no, but you know, in one story that L.A. went through three mayors and three police chiefs before that consent decree was lifted.
Right, and that is another interesting thing to me that's been pointed out by the experts, that what happens really does depend on your mayor and your police chief in terms of movement and how quickly things happen. Some cities fight it initially. You know, they may say, we think you're wrong. We don't have these problems. And that obviously would delay things.
Well, and then there's also a cost involved, too. I mean, to implement any reforms or changes in the through the court monitoring process, I know you had one expert said that could approach $100 million.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, that's a lot of money. But I think the city's last estimate of, I think, like a decade of legal costs and lawsuits is like $500 million. So, you know, so it's costly either way.
But, you know, let's face it, if it's spending money for progress versus spending money for avoiding litigation for wrongful issues, I think everybody would probably side with progress.
Certainly. I think, you know, those are just financial costs. I think there's a whole lot of other costs that people would point to if you don't fix these kind of issues.
That's Annie Sweeney. She's police and courts reporter, my colleague at the Chicago Tribune. Annie, thanks for getting up with me this morning.
You bet. Thanks. Have a great day.
You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, Dave Yepsen, director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale. And as I said earlier, my go-to guy when it comes to Iowa politics, and we'll be talking about the effect of these recent Republican and Democratic debates on the voters in Iowa.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas to you. We've been playing a little bit of some of the sounds of the holidays with the Illinois Ripcords, the women's premier a cappella group at the University of Illinois. This is actually a CD from a couple of years back when the show's unofficial music director, Amanda, was part of the group. And yeah, let's hear a little bit more.
Shining, this is the night of our dear Savior's birth. Ooh. Long lay the world in sin and error pining till he appeared and the soul. Rejoices till yon
That was the University of Illinois Ripcords. They're providing our Christmas music entertainment this morning here on the Sunday Spin. We were touching on the debates that were held last week, the Republican debates, as well as last night's Democratic debates, and wanted to run through some of the more notable exchanges there. There's been a lot of talk about whether Donald Trump would actually leave the party if he doesn't do well in Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Republicans very fearful that if he ran an independent bid, how that could draw votes from whoever the Republican nominee might be. Donald Trump used the debate to pledge his allegiance to the Republican Party, though such pledges really may mean little.
I've gained great respect for the Republican leadership. I've gained great respect for many, and I'm going to even say, well, I mean, in different forms, for the people on the dais.
No,
in different forms. In different forms. But I have great respect for the people I've met through this process. I've never done this process before. I've never been a politician. I mean, for the last 6 months, I've been a politician. But I will tell you, I am totally committed to the Republican Party. I feel very honored to be the front runner. And I think I'll do very well if I'm chosen, if I'm so fortunate to be chosen. I think I'll do very well. Polls have come out recently say I would beat Hillary. I will do everything in my power to beat Hillary Clinton, I can promise you.
And that was Donald Trump. One person who used the debate, the Republican debate, to try to move forward, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. Christie being endorsed by the big paper in New Hampshire, where it looks like that is actually going to be the place he makes a move rather than Iowa. But he's trying to show some, I guess you would say, New Jersey toughness.
But I would do it. A no-fly zone means a no-fly zone. Wolf, that's what it means. See, maybe because I'm from New Jersey, I have this kind of plain language hang up, but I would make very clear, I would not talk to Vladimir Putin. In fact, I would talk to Vladimir Putin a lot. And I'd say to him, listen, Mr. President, there's no fly zone in Syria. You fly in, it applies to you. And yes, we would shoot down the planes of Russian pilots if, in fact, they were stupid enough to think that this president was the same feckless weakling that the president we have in the Oval Office is right now.
Senator Paul, I want you to respond to what we just heard from Governor Christie. If there was a no-fly zone, you say that potentially could lead to World War III. Why?
Well, I think if you're in favor of World War III, you have your candidate. You know, here's the thing. My goodness, what we want in a leader is someone with judgment, not someone who is so reckless as to stand on the stage and say, yes, I'm jumping up and down. I'm going to shoot down Russian planes. Russia already flies in that airspace. It may not be something we're in love with the fact that they're there, but they were invited by Iraq and by Syria to fly in that airspace. And so if we announce that we're going to have a no-fly zone, and others have said this, Hillary Clinton's also for it, it is a recipe for disaster. It's a recipe for World War III. We need to confront Russia from a position of strength, but we don't need to confront Russia from a point of recklessness that would lead to war. This is something, this type of judgment, you know, it's having that kind of judgment, who you would appoint and how you're going to conduct affairs, that is incredibly important. I mean, I think when we think about the judgment of someone who might want World War III, we might think about someone who might shut down a bridge because they don't like their friends. They don't want to, you know, they want to get a Democrat.
Kind of a very interesting, sharp exchange there between Kentucky Senator Rand Paul and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. Of course, Rand Paul kind of come under some criticism over more hawkish elements within the Republican Party, believing that Rand Paul is more of a, I guess you would say, isolationist. I also want to play one cut, too. We talked about the debate last night in New Hampshire, the third presidential debate, and it originally going in, it had the makings of a lot of fireworks over the disclosure that staffers for Bernie Sanders had found a way to tap into voter data being put together by Hillary Clinton through the Democratic National Committee's voter base, a vendor for the DNC. The DNC suspended Sanders' access to the data files, but later rescinded that, and Sanders has now fired one staffer and suspended two others. And last night, Bernie Sanders apologized.
Yes, I apologize.
Secretary Clinton, do you accept?
Not only do I apologize to Secretary Clinton, and I hope we can work together on an independent investigation from day one, I want to apologize to my supporters. This is not the type of campaign that we run. And if I find anybody else involved in this, they will also be fired.
Secretary Clinton, he's apologized. How do you react?
I very much appreciate that comment, Bernie. It really is important that we go forward on this. I know that you now have your data back and that there has been an agreement for an independent inquiry into what did happen. Obviously, we were distressed when we learned of it because we've worked very hard. I said in the beginning of this campaign, we wanted to reach as many voters as possible, and we have tens of thousands of volunteers doing that and entering data all the time to keep up with what people are telling us. And so now that I think, you know, we've resolved your data, we've agreed on a independent inquiry, we should move on, because I don't think the American people are all that interested in this. I think they're more interested in what we have to say about all the big issues facing us.
So that effectively took the data mining issue as of right now off the table. When we come back, we'll be speaking with David Yepsen, director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, and joining me on the phone is David Yepsen, director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale. David, thanks for getting up with me this morning.
Good to be with you, Rick.
Sorry, we had trouble connecting, but I wondered, you know, when it comes down to it, when you look at the Republican debate last week, last night's Democratic debate, one, I'm not sure anybody watched last night's debate.
Right.
On purpose. But are these debates moving anybody in Iowa?
At this point, I don't think so. I certainly don't think the Democratic debate moved anything. It, as you point out, a horrible evening in Iowa. The UNI was playing Iowa State in basketball, scored an upset. And you know, people were just focused on the holiday. And I don't think the Republican debate really moved much. But in that said, Rick, Ted Cruz is rising in Iowa, and Marco Rubio is a little bit too. Ben Carson is slipping, and Donald Trump is sort of flatlined. The other thing that's going on here in this race is Cruz really does seem to have a superior organization. And if these trajectories continue with that superior organization, he can win Iowa.
Well, and he's playing to the right audience in Iowa. It just took him a while to get there.
That's right. As Ben Carson falls, Ted Cruz is picking up evangelical voters and Tea Party voters. He's running a very sophisticated, well-organized campaign. He's spending time. He's doing everything correctly on the ground, and that is very important, as you know. Rubio has got some upside potential, but he doesn't have – I don't think he has the organizational infrastructure. You know, all that said, we're nearing the caucuses. But I don't expect things to firm up until long after January 1st. These caucus goers are better educated, higher income, motivated workers, even than primary voters. And I think what we're going to see happen is what's happened in the past. People have some initial preferences, but they're going to wait and see how this thing plays out some more. There is another Republican debate in January. It's not in Iowa, but a lot of people will wait till the very end, Rick, and I think you'll see a dynamic at the caucus itself where neighbors are talking to neighbors and saying, you know, Joe, what do you think? Well, I don't like so-and-so. And that has an impact on the outcome.
You know, when you look at the layout of the calendar for the caucus and primary season, and you look at Cruz rising, I'm not sure that it'll do necessarily that well in New Hampshire, but then when you start moving back to the South and you've got the SEC primaries, those kinds of things, you can almost see a pathway.
Oh, no question about it. And doing well in Iowa and winning Iowa in an upset over Trump would really give him that proverbial momentum and a lot of media attention. I don't know. As you're correct, I'm not sure it's enough to put him over the top in New Hampshire. But, you know, just remember something, Rick, that, and you've seen this before. Trump, a lot of Trump's crowds, are great crowds. He gets a lot of attention and in the media. But will they show up on caucus night? His organization is not as good. And I think a lot of Trump voters, they're looking at celebrity. They're looking at they're turning out to see Donald Trump. It's not a sign that he's going to win. You saw the same thing in the Democratic Party, Rick. You remember back in 84 and 88 with Jesse Jackson. Great crowd.
Right.
Said things people liked, but they didn't vote for him on caucus night.
Well, and frankly, it's kind of like Ron Paul, too.
Exactly. And there are Republicans who like what they hear. That still just aren't going to show up.
Were you surprised about the results last week, virtually a week ago, with the Des Moines Register poll, Bloomberg poll, Ann Seltzer did, 31-21 Cruz over Trump, and, that just seems like such a huge momentum shift.
Well, that is, and it's a little bigger than other polls are showing. But even if you look at the average of the most recent polls, you've still got Cruz up a point or two,
right,
in Iowa. I've done a lot of work with Ann Seltzer and that poll over the years, and they know what they're doing.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Because it is very hard, and it's different to poll caucus goers.
Right, but just look at the trend lines. That's what I think is important, and it's clear Cruz has got some momentum here.
There also was a recent public policy poll, which is a Democratic-oriented polling, but it showed, this is nationally, it had Trump 34, Cruz 18, Rubio 13, and Bush at 7, Carson at 6. And here again, I think it's a matter of looking at the trend lines here.
That's right. And that'll change on a dime once you get Iowa and New Hampshire. Those numbers will move quickly. I wouldn't pay much attention to national polls right now.
No.
Look at the trend lines in Iowa and New Hampshire, and that'll give you some idea where this race is headed.
But I do think there is a value there of just looking at the precipitous fall of Ben Carson.
Oh, yeah. And his lack of fluency on foreign policy and military questions, I think, are causing a lot of his evangelical supporters to look elsewhere. And Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio are in a good position to pick those up. Cruz has got a better organization to reel them in.
Real quickly on the Democratic side. So, I watched some of the debate. I couldn't stay up late enough to catch all of it. But I thought it was very interesting. I played that cut of the Bernie Sanders apology, and it just... I thought the way the campaigns were battling this weekend that was going to be a kind of a featured rift here between those two. And it was over and done with.
That's right. He apologized, put it behind him. It's Christmas. We move on. And the race, the curtain comes up right after January 1st.
And so last night after the debate, Sanders' campaign points out that they have, in their words, have crossed the record-breaking mark of campaign donations that was set by President Barack Obama at more than 2.2 million donations, and the average contribution for the night was below $25, part of this grassroots sales campaign. Does that in the end mean anything?
I think it does. I think those small donations are shareholders, they're stockholders. If you donate money to a candidate, there's a probability that you're going to go show up for them at a caucus, particularly here in Iowa. And I can tell you the Hillary Clinton people are taking this very seriously. They thought they were in great shape in 2008. Their comeuppance. They ran a good campaign in 2008, but they're not taking anything for granted. In fact, I think the Clinton people see a chance to beat Bernie Sanders here. She does lead in the polls among Democrats. And if she does that, she's going to be in a lot better shape in New Hampshire, where Sanders is doing better. So the last thing Hillary Clinton needs is to have Bernie Sanders embarrass her here. That could really cause problems for her down the road.
That's David Yepsen, director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale. David, thank you very much, and have a Merry Christmas.
You too, Rick. Merry Christmas.
We'll be back with more right after this. Well, that's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank everyone for listening, and I wish everybody a very Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays. And, Dean, I have to tell you, a couple of events in Washington lately actually made me think you might be better suited at doing some of the politics.
Oh, I don't know about that.
During the White House briefing where a copy of the new Star Wars movie was being shown.
Right.
Josh Ernst was surrounded by stormtroopers on the stage of the briefing room.
I thought there were some characters there.
And which one thing I might get, if I were in the Secret Service, I might be a little upset about that.
About guys
in full costumes.
Helmets and carrying weapons, yeah.
And then last night, at the end of the debate, Hillary Clinton said thank you to everybody, and then may the force be with you.
Nice.
So,
nice to see they're all, their top focuses on our nation's problems.
we all need a bit of entertainment, but I do want to wish you a Merry Christmas.
Same to you. You're in the spirit with your Santa hat on this morning.
Well, it's the leftover hat from the Miracle on 34th Street adaptation.
Oh, the big extravaganza.
Yes, indeed. And it was.
It was a big extravaganza. I have a few things to say about that coming up after the news on Chicago's Bear. And Merry Christmas to you too, Rick.
Thank you much.
Grinch is here.